There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, and there you have it.
There you go.
With the qualifying.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Faub, my co-host. This is podcast number 1099, June 16th, 2025, Stephen.
This F1 Weekly podcast brought to you by Yahoo Ads. Yahoo Ads bring you the F1Weekly.com website for the ads that interest you. From tickets on the Orient Express to flights to Istanbul, Yahoo Ads gives you stuff you really want. Click on them, you know you want to.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you, Yahoo Ads. On today's program, George converts pole into a Grand Prix win in Canada over Max Verstappen. Norris crashes into Piastri, bringing out the safety car, and we all were waiting for this moment, and there it is. Quicker than I expected, I have to admit. Frédéric Vasseur under extreme pressure as Robert Kubica wins at Le Mans for Ferrari in a privately owned vehicle. Absolutely outstanding. The Ferraris look fantastic. And congratulations to Robert Kubica, Lewis Hamilton's favorite driver. And on today's program, more classic Nasser Hamid with another fantastic set of interviews. This week we have Olivier Panis, of course, one of the few French that have won at Monaco, and IndyCar journalist extraordinaire, the late Robin Miller. Fantastic. Fantastic. Nass enjoyed that conversation for sure. And yes, we do need your contributions to keep this program up on the cloud. So please just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab. You know you want to. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, the moment we've been waiting for. Of course, the Max Verstappen chaos and comparisons to the mighty greats of Formula One, Senna, Schumacher, the bad boys, the people who always went above and beyond the rules and regulations often enough. But Max apologized to everybody. Everything is fine, and we move on with another interesting situation, and of course, that's at McLaren with Norris always making the strangest mistakes with a very quick car under his bouteille. And Piastri, the calm, cool Iceman from Australia. So it's very interesting, but Mark Webber is doing a fantastic job. But we have to give our kudos to George for driving a fantastic race, not letting Max intimidate him, and he had a fantastic start. A great qualifying lap, the best he's ever put out, and then to hold that pole position and get the win was fantastic. Quickly to Lance Stroll, he didn't race in Spain, he comes back in Canada, but a dismal, unmotivated individual if I've ever seen one. And you have to sit there and scratch your head. You know, and I'm not saying he's a terrible driver. I think he's very talented. He's won many championships in the lower formulae. But he just doesn't have the motivation and the hunger. I mean, when you're a billionaire and you're only 18, it's hard to find that hunger. And now, you know, he's been racing in Formula One for a while. And it's lackadaisical at best, especially when Fernando is making it to Q3, qualifying in P6, P5. It is a head scratcher, nevertheless. But wow, Mercedes looking good. Even Antonelli on the podium. This was great for Toto, great for Mercedes, chairman of the board. And it was good for Formula One. We need to mix it up a little bit. Obviously, McLaren struggling a little bit there, but the cooler weather paid off for Mercedes, but not for McLaren. So are they losing their je ne sais quoi? And is Red Bull catching up barely? I still think they're pretty static. No movement forward or backwards. And Yuki Tsunoda is just another number two to Max. Nobody seems to be able to fill this position adequately. So Red Bull will not be winning Constructors' Championships until they get that balanced out. In the meantime, Lawson looks pretty lackadaisical up against Hajar, who's really doing a great job for the Racing Bulls, but he has admitted going to Red Bull would be scary. Yes, I agree. Dr. Marco lurking. So it's interesting as we go to Austria for the home Grand Prix of Red Bull, and it's somewhat of a home Grand Prix for Max because we're getting closer to Zandvoort. And Max is on a roll. He made up some points with Norris making that huge error, which was really bizarre. It's almost like his brain shut down because obviously there was no room. If you're in the grass, you're no room. It should. If you see green, don't go there. So it was quite astonishing. Because he does qualify well when he has his act together. But I've mentioned the sensibility of this young man many times before on the show. Nasser has witnessed the tearing up when things don't go well for him. And I presume that happened this time as well. But he took it on the chin. He apologized to everybody immediately. There was no gray area. He took full responsibility. So that's always good. And Max is still in it. I still think he has a chance to win this if McLaren start fumbling. And the tires are the biggest problem. You can't really guess what's going on with these tires. So it's a rough one. I think sacrifice has to be made in qualifying to have good tires in the race. I wish they had more tires. And I wish it wasn't so tire dependable. Dependent, should I say, on the Grand Prix, because I just want to see flat-out racing, which we don't get anymore. It's more management than anything else. And I understand the cerebral part of that, but us crude people want to just see flat-out racing. And then we had the little hiccup with Danica Patrick stating that this track is the easiest, or one of the easiest, on the Formula One schedule. And then Martin Brundle and Nico Rosberg looked at each other and said, "Who is this woman? This is an extremely difficult track." So Danica thought that the shoe made it difficult, not necessarily the chicanes and the track layout. So there you have it. Classic Danica Patrick. And I wish Nasser was here for that, because it does get us a few laughs and another round of fresh beer. But once again, Max comes out clean here, couldn't do anything. And I didn't like how George said, "Well, I've got points I can gamble with," where Max does not. So, but bad taste happens in every corner of life. But nevertheless, we have a fantastic race. Unfortunately, we still need Ferrari to be closer to the front. Frederick Vasseur under a lot of pressure. He is aware of becoming Ferrari principal. There was pressure involved. And choosing what seemed to be a logical choice, Lewis Hamilton, has turned into a large headache for everybody. And I think it's bringing the team down a little bit. Now, I do feel Lewis Hamilton's pain when he hit the gopher or the beaver. I'm not sure what kind of animal, but I don't like hurting anything myself. So he was traumatized. He's still traumatized. And it'll take weeks for him to get over that. But it is what it is. They did finish P5 and P6, which is where they're stuck. And then you had Albon losing an important parts of his car during Q1, which was really bizarre. Not much from the FIA on that. They got to continue. So I think flying debris is better than phantom debris. And of course, I watched Le Mans, and it was exciting. It was between Porsche and Ferrari and Robert Kubica to see him being successful after his tragic accident, losing most of the functionality of his arm, and to see him do an Alex Zanardi for me, that's what I call it, to come back and win at Le Mans in a privately entered Ferrari, the yellow Ferrari, number 83. And of course, Porsche Penske came in second to ruin the Ferrari 123. But nevertheless, great for Ferrari, great for the privately entered Ferrari, and fantastic for the Poles, for Robert Kubica. I'm sure LCH was texting him. That was really a good feeling in everybody's gut. Great race. It was very, very competitive. Even in the lower LM GT3 class. So, very exciting to watch. Once again, I love every minute of Le Mans. I did watch a little IndyCar. It was an oval somewhere in Iowa. I'm not quite sure. 1.25 miles. I don't know. It's just hard to watch sometimes. But the accidents were pretty scary. And if you're not in the right place at the right time, it can be even scarier with several big shunts at the WW Grand Prix in wherever they were. So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Now let's get to the interviews. This is a fantastic interview. Olivier Panis, for sure, driving for Prost, French team. Their only win, Monaco, fantastic, awesome. You got to give it to them. Right up there with Trintignant. And we also have a classic interview because this is a journalist talking to a journalist. So you get in-depth nuance. And Robin Miller was wonderful. He knew everything about motorsports. Obviously, he was a specialist when it came to IndyCar, having it covered for years and years and years. But it took a long time for Nas to put this interview together, and when he finally got it, it was love at first sight. These guys got along so well. And you'll hear that in the interview. Robin Miller was very, very accommodating, very easy to talk to, was always very approachable in the paddock. So this is a nice interview. Enjoy. And don't forget, everybody, yes, we miss Nasser every day.
Hi, I'm Lockie Hughes. You're listening to F1 Weekly.
Hello, this is Andrew with this week's F1Weekly.com trivia question. Since we have the Canadian Grand Prix this weekend, let's go with a Canuck-flavoured question. Canadian driver Al Pease only drove in two Grand Prix races, the 1967 and 1969 Canadian Grand Prix for the Eagle team. He was black flagged, that is disqualified, in the 1969 race for what reason? A. Starting in the wrong grid position. B. Driving too slowly. C. Driving too fast in the pits. Or D. Driving the wrong way around the circuit. And I'll be back later in the show with the answer.
We get a lot of great interviews, but this one, another pinnacle is reached. Introduce this man.
Well, it's Miller time, Robin Miller. And Robin Miller knows more about IndyCar racing than anybody dead or alive. He really knows, and what he's really good at is getting the scoops. You know, some years ago, he broke the story that Tony George is being booted out. And then what happened, the organization issued a statement that this is wrong. The team owner sent a letter of support to him. So for like a week or 10-day period, it looked like Robin got it wrong. And then sure enough, like 3 weeks later, he was booted out. So he's in the know. He used to be a race car driver. He was with the Indianapolis Star for many, many years. A lot of great stories, and I always listen to what he has to say and also read his column on speedtv.com. Lots of stories. So it was great talking to him. I've been chasing him for a while, and finally he was at home and we did the Skype thingy. Then my thanks to him, and I hope our listeners, especially Mr. Luling, Louisiana, Mr. DeHardy Jr., you know, he's a big passionate fan of IndyCar racing, so I hope people enjoy this. And we will have more. The boy has asked for more.
Oh, please leave a message after the tone.
Mr. Miller, this is Nasser calling from California. Hope all is well. When you are available, will you please call me at 408-5639?
Hey!
Mr. Miller!
What's happening?
You tell me. What's going on?
I never answer unknown calls because I always figure it's somebody trying to sell me something.
Or ask for money.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Well. How's the weather in Indianapolis?
Well, it's 28 degrees and sunny, brother. It's cold.
It's cold. Are you loving
it? Always cold in February and March.
Okay, great. Now, how much time do you have today?
Well, I got about 10 or 15 minutes, probably.
Oh, we need more time from you than that, please.
More time?
Yeah, because you're hard to get.
No, I'm not hard to get. I'm easy to get. What is it you guys got? Are you guys got a radio show or a...
It's a racing podcast, and you have so much history hidden in your vault that I want to tap into some of it.
Well, let's just start. Let's fire it up and we'll go.
Yeah, and whenever you have to go, let me know, and we can do it some other time also, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, we'll try and do most of it right now, because I'm going to get busy here in about a week, and I ain't going to be around much.
Yeah, no, I'll try to do it no more than 30 minutes. How's that?
Okay.
Okay, let me do a little introduction. Okay, folks, on the line, Mr. Miller, Robin Miller, that is. Robin, welcome to F1 Weekly. How are you, sir?
I'm cold, but I'm old, but I'm fine. How are you doing?
I'm doing very good. Loving life in California. Thank you.
Well, you should. All those great calendars you put out every year. I hope you make a little money, because those are good calendars.
Thank you so much, and I really appreciate your plug-in and also your support every year.
Everybody I give those to Christmas presents for always goes, these are the best. Where'd they come from? And I think most people I know, because they're probably old, cherish the past.
Yeah, same here. Okay, first of all, congratulations. Your prayers have been answered. Both TG and TGBB are gone from Indy cars. Are you a happy camper, or someone else has appeared on the Robin radar ready for a laser strike?
No, I'd say that TGBB's not gone. He still works at IndyCar. He's just out of race control, which is long overdue. He ought to be out of the building, but I don't know. He's still hanging in there. I don't know what they have him doing, but at least he's not going to be able to screw up the races. And, of course, Tony George is going to be a co-owner of Ed Carpenter's team, so he's still around. It's just that – and he's back on the board of – you know, he's pretty much back on the board of Holman and Company. So, I mean, Tony will still have some influence and things like that. It's just that it's kind of a different era now. We've got new cars, new engines. A couple of new teams, hopefully. And, Randy Bernard has done a good job of trying to identify some of the problems. Now, he still needs some help on the racing side. And there's a lot of things he can't learn in 2 years and he'll never learn. So, but at least I think there's more optimism than there has been.
You know, the past is past, but I do want to ask you one question, because you used to bring this up quite a bit in your writing. And I'm a big fan of Robin Miller's writings. I've heard you say that it was Fran's family that really wanted Tony George to start the IRL and screw up the Champ cars. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that, please?
Well, sure. It makes sense that in 1993, when Nigel Mansell came over here, CART was the biggest thing in motorsports. It was getting better ratings in England and in Brazil and in Australia than Formula One was. It's on a par with NASCAR TV-wise, and certainly, at least sponsorship-wise, it had just as much money coming in. So, basically, the people would really benefit if something happened to Open Wheel was NASCAR. They were going to be the big beneficiaries, them and Bernie Ecclestone. But I think what people don't understand is that the most important thing to remember is that Bill France was in Tony George's ear that whole time saying, hey, you know what, I sure would say that you shouldn't have coroners telling you what to do. You need to go out there and start your own deal. I don't disagree with that. I mean, coroners have shown over the years they aren't the guys that you can really count on because they're so greedy and they're always working out and looking out for themselves. And we've really never had a Bernie Ecclestone in IndyCar or a Bill France. We've never had that. But when Tony George started the IndyCar series, it was the absolute. He couldn't have picked a worse time to divide open wheel racing. If he'd have done it in the late 80s, it probably would have worked if he'd have stuck to his guns and made it all Americans. But don't forget that everything Tony George said he hated about CART is exactly what the IRL became. And the one guy that was in his ear the whole time was Bill France. And I even confronted Bill France once and said, you know, you have to be pretty happy your big plan worked. And he said, you know, what are you talking about? I said, you know, convincing Tony George to start his own series. I said, well, he got mad and kind of stormed off. So I just think that, you know, and look what has happened. I mean, it was divided and NASCAR conquered. I always laugh when I hear people say the IRL won the war. No, NASCAR won the war. Open wheel racing lost the war, period.
Yeah, lost the war and the battle.
Yes.
Okay, now, I was watching the ARCA race from Daytona, and I had to think of you. At one stage, Milka was running ahead of some guy named Coffee. Will you miss the Venezuelan donuts now that Miss Patrick is also gone?
Milk and donuts. She's in the perfect series. ARCA stock cars on a big track. Of course, I did see she spun down the straightaway, but I guess somebody spun her out.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I suppose that, you know, she seems like a nice person, but there's no chance that she would have ever been given a license back in the 60s or 70s because she had to be a real race driver. And I think, you know, I think IndyCar is going to miss Danica just because she was good for the sport. She drew a lot of attention to this thing, and she gave us fans that we'd never had before and great media coverage. And NASCAR now is going to be the benefactor of all that. But what I liked about Danica was her attitude, her spirit, her spunk. She was a serious little race driver, and if anybody watched her and Tony Kanaan run the last 25 laps at Homestead a couple years ago,
yes,
and she ended up beating him for second place. And they tell me that she's not a race driver, or she doesn't have balls, or she's not afraid to mix it up. They weren't paying attention because she's always had a lot of moxie, and that's what I always liked about her.
I watched that race, and that was very, very impressive, no question. Now, you know everything that happens in Indy cars. I want to ask you a question. One of the first issues she had was with Jacques Lazier. Is it true that she slapped him in the emergency vehicle?
I think she gave him a little smack. Yeah, she might have given him a little, you know, just a little push or something like that.
Okay, cool, cool.
You know, I mean, she shoved Ann Weldon a little bit at Milwaukee once, and I don't know. I mean, I just say that, you know, the thing about it is she always, you know, she's always had that attitude. I mean, when she was 15 years old, she had a real firm handshake, and she was a cocky little shit. Well, that's okay. That's what you have to be.
Yeah.
And I think it served her well, and I think that attitude will help her down south.
Well, the best was the towel fight between her and Milka.
Oh, yeah, the towel fight. I actually own that towel. I bought it in an auction to benefit a crew member that was burned a few years ago, and I paid $500 for it. So I have that towel.
Is it signed by both of them?
Well, no, I didn't get it signed. That's It's just in its unfettered. It's just, it's still got the dirt on it from where it got drug across the pits.
Beautiful. Okay. Open wheel racing fans were all happy when the IndyCar Civil War was over. Are you satisfied with the progress that has been made to bring back fans to the track and also the TV ratings?
Well, I mean, you know, their oval tracks are almost dead because when we had the split, this is always what cracks me up. The people that came in and started becoming IndyCar fans at 96 when the IRL was started, and some of the people that were working for the Speedway at the time were great history revisionists because they were saying, well, IndyCar racing was on its way down. Oh, really? There were 54,000 people at Milwaukee in 1995, standing room only. 64,000 people at Phoenix. 78,000 people at Michigan. Those ovals were all strong, strong. Fontana had 55 or 60,000 people. Where did all those people go? Well, they either went to NASCAR or they quit watching racing because they got mad at the IRL and CART. And I don't know what the answer is to get people back to the ovals because the racing on the ovals has always been good and exciting. The racing last year in Milwaukee and Loudon was good, and there was 12,000 people there. Now they're going to go back to Milwaukee this year with Michael Andretti, and that's good because I think they'll do a good job of promoting it, and we need to keep Milwaukee. And we need to have, you know, I mean, oval racing is IndyCar's heritage. We need ovals. But, you know, we've had to go to more street races and road courses because that's where the people have been showing up. So as far as attendance-wise, I don't know. I think it's made a little bit of a comeback. The Indy 500 had a lot more people last year than it had since the split. It was by far the best crowd. They probably only had 20,000 empty seats out of 250,000, which is damn good, especially compared to the Brickyard, which had about 90,000 people. So as far as the TV ratings, ABC gets 1.5 to 2 million people almost every time they have a race by accident, except the Indy 500. It gets the biggest crowd, obviously. It gets 3 or 4 or 5 million. But, you know, I worked for Versus last year. Now it's NBC Sports Network, and they do a good job of putting the race on, but, you know, they were getting 400,000, 450,000 people watching the race, and when you see NASCAR gets 5 or 6 million, it's tough to sell sponsorships. So they got a lot of work to do to try and get their TV ratings build up, but I hope NBC does a good job of helping promote. If NBC would use its network to promote its NBC Sports Network, its cable show, it could drive a little traffic there, but, IndyCar racing's still got a long way to go on TV, and it's way, way, way behind NASCAR.
Yeah. Talking of ovals, you know, I used to love races at Michigan. Do you remember the two races they had and the battle between Mario Andretti and Tom Sneba in 1984, I believe it was?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That was classic. Yeah.
Mario chopped Sneba a couple times to win the race, and Sneba was mad after the race, and I asked Mario about it, and he says, he'll get over it by Tuesday.
That's too early for
Sneba. There were some great races there. John Paul Jr. won the race in 83, beat Rick Mears.
Right.
Probably one of the great races was when Scott Pruitt passed Al Unser Jr. in the fourth turn of the last lap.
Yeah.
The first victory, Firestone's first victory back when they came back in 1995.
Right.
So just a lot of cool things. Michigan was always a great IndyCar track, always.
And then the
crowds, you know, when the IRL came in, the crowds started getting worse and worse and worse, and finally, you know, that they pulled the plug and said, you know, this is a loser. We don't want him anymore.
Yeah. And that Montoya win over Michael was also incredible.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say, the other great finish was Michael and Montoya when neither one of them were going to back off, banging wheels at 225 miles an hour.
Yeah, that was something. Now, I hear you invite Indy rookie drivers to Mug and Bun, a fine eatery in your town. And I understand Stefan Johansson took some time to get used to it.
Yeah, I took Stefan when he first came back and was driving for Tony Bentonhausen. I took him to the Mug and Bun for lunch one day, and he said, what should I get? I said, well, try a breaded tenderloin. He goes, what's that? I said, well, just try it. And so he ate it, and he thought it was okay. And then about a week later, he called me up, and he said, hey, that tenderloin's still in my stomach. I can't digest it. What the hell's in that thing? So I told him to just, you know, he'd be all right in a couple of weeks. And we still laugh about that. But when I was working at ESPN, there was a show called RPM Tonight. It was on every night.
Uh-huh.
And Wednesday night was Open Wheel Wednesday, and that was the night I was always on. And they let me do some features. And one time I took Bruno Junqueira and Nick Manassian to the Mug and Bun. and the Mug and Bun saw the cameras and everything, and they're all good people anyway, so they gave us everything on the menu. They gave us for free for these guys to try, and Bruno hated everything, and Nick Manassian loved everything. And right. It was just funny to see their reactions, because Manassian's from France, and he'd never had anything fried in his life, and Bruno's kind of a health nut, and he couldn't believe people would eat cheese French fries and tater tots and all the fried food that we had. So the best part was, when we got done, my photographer, Jim Roeder, was a pretty big guy, played football in college, asked those two guys if they were done eating, and they said, yep. He said, so, okay, I'm going to show you how to eat now. So he ate everything on the plate or on the table. And I think what's great is that the Mug and Bun kind of has this reputation now that a lot of people want to kind of, you know, Charlie Kimball and some of the rookies last year said, hey, you know, should we try that Mug and Bun? I said, absolutely. Because, you know, drivers are pretty health conscious now, so a lot of them probably aren't ready for a big injection of grease.
I think James Hinchcliffe would love that place.
Oh, yeah. Now, Hinchcliffe, he would be a good fry cook. It'd be a good part-time job for him there. He could be a waiter.
Oh, great, great. Yeah, especially now that he's got the GoDaddy outfit, he's looking pretty cute.
Yep. That's what we call him, Danica Hinchcliffe, James Patrick, they call him Manica.
Yeah. That's beautiful. Okay, now you have also been in the driving seat from Formula Forge to Midgets. Please tell us a little bit about your racing adventure.
Well, I mean, I grew up in Indianapolis, and so I was going to Terre Haute and Eldora and Winchester and Salem and in the early 60s, and I kind of fell in love with Jim Herdebees, who I thought was the bravest, wildest, most exciting driver I ever saw. And I got to stooge for him at the Indy 500 in 1968, which was the last year that a roadster made the show. Jim qualified. It was the last roadster to make the Indy 500, and I got to be on the pit crew. And so then, you know, I was always interested, but about 1972, Art Pollard was a really good buddy of mine, and I was always saying, boy, I'd really like to race. And he goes, well, sell your sports car, and I'll help you buy a race car. So he was driving for Andy Granatelli, and I bought my first car from Andy Granatelli. It was a Formula Ford, and I raced it for about a year. And then I'm eating lunch and dinner every night with Gary Bentenhausen and Bill Vukovich and Johnny Parsons and Lee Koonsman and Steve Chassis and all these guys that are running USAC. And they're saying, look, if you want to learn how to drive a race car, get rid of that Formula Ford and go out and get a midget or a sprint car, and you'll learn how to race. Well, they were right. It was, I bought a midget from Gary Bentenhausen in 1974, and I got to race USAC until 1983, until I was out of money and way in debt. But it was by far the greatest time of my life, because you have to remember, in the mid to late 70s, a lot of the IndyCar drivers were still running USAC midgets and sprints to make ends meet. So I think the first night I made a feature, a USAC midget feature, they started 20 cars, and it was the first time I'd ever been on dirt, and I made the main event, and 12 or 13 guys in the race that night had been in that year's Indy 500. So it was kind of weird, because all the guys I'd been writing about for 5 or 6 years in the paper, Indianapolis Star, then I'm suddenly racing, you know, I'm trying to learn how to race, and I was very conscious of trying to stay out of their way and try to learn, and you know, I had my moments, but I wasn't very smart. I did a lot of stupid things in a race car. I should have never owned a race car, because I was such a mechanical moron. I had no business owning a race car, and it was guys that, like Bobby Grimm and Ronnie Schumann and Larry Rice, people like that, helped keep me alive, because they were always helping me on my car, because they knew I was not smart enough to even type my own wheels. So it was an experience. If I ever wrote a book, there would be some things that would be pretty funny to read, and I wouldn't have to embellish any of them, because they all happened. I don't think you probably can't do as many things wrong as far as racing a car and owning your own car and towing it around the country as I did. But it was a great experience, and I learned a lot. And I just wish I'd have started before I was 23 years old. I think about these kids today, like Kyle Larson. He's 19 years old. I've never seen anybody any better than him, anybody. And he's been racing since he was, 10. and he's got so much experience. He's so good. He's so on top of a race car. And a lot of these kids are Cole Witt, all these kids that, that I've watched come up through USAC. And, I mean, I tell you what, between driver schools and guys getting to drive sprint cars when they're 14 years old, it's a completely new generation.
Yeah, it's a new world. Now, going back to the Jim Hurtubise qualifying, I understand you're in the Speedway's official qualifying photo. How did you achieve that?
Well, I mean, I cut school because they had an extra day of qualifying in 1968 because of the weather. And Jim had fired me from his team because I had messed up and ruined a paint job on the Roadster had a great big long nose, and he just got Pepsi and Frito-Lay to sponsor him. And one of my jobs was to put the bodywork on the car, and with a little Zeus wrench, and I got all nervous because Jim was in a hurry to get out and practice, and I put a big scratch right through the middle of the paint job. So he said, "I got to let you go. You're incompetent. I can't keep you." So I got, even though I was working for free, I still got fired, which is hard to, you know. They fired the free help, which is, it's hard to get fired when you're free help. So then I cut school and went out and watched him qualify, and he saw me standing there on the fence. And so after they took about half a dozen qualifying pictures, he motioned me to come all over, and I jumped over the fence, and I think I got in a couple of them near the end. So, you know, and then Jim and I became pretty good friends, and just one of the best people, you know. He was never the same after he got burned at Milwaukee in 1964, but my God, was he a good race driver.
Now, Robin Miller getting fired has happened in quite a few places, but that's a totally separate story some other days.
Well, yeah. You got to remember, I was at the Indianapolis Star for 33 years and never got fired. And now, you know, then I got fired there. I didn't get fired at ESPN. That was good. And I've worked for all five TV stations here in Indianapolis, and I didn't get fired from any of those either. So I've had my moments. I got fired from the Champ Car website for bad-mouthing Champ Cars management. So it's always fun.
Okay, now, will you please tell our listeners, why was Tom Sneema fired from his TV gig?
Well, he was fired from ESPN 2. And one day it was during practice in 97 when they had 2 hours of nobody on the cars, you know. There hadn't been anybody on the track, not one car for 2 hours. So obviously they're killing time. And Tom said something about, man, you know, it's this is the kind of day that Gary Bettenhausen would probably take Sam Schmidt and his team over to Brad's Gold Club and buy some lap dances and show them how to properly tuck a dollar bill or something like that. It was on ESPN2. So Tom didn't think about it because nobody was watching anyway. And of course that was the final straw. They were outraged that he'd said something like that.
The gas man really gassed it up, huh?
Yeah, and you know, he did a good job on TV because he has a personality and a sense of humor.
Yeah. Okay, now talking of fired, you have fired rockets of two American legends, both from Texas. Please tell us what got A.J. Foyt and Jim Hall all upset with Robin Miller.
Well, A.J. got mad in 1981 because he was going about 10 miles an hour faster down the straightaway than anybody else. And I pointed that out in the story, so he smacked me, and we didn't speak for about a year. But then we became, you know, we got along after that. We got along, I always got along really well with him, and I think it was because he knew how serious I was about racing, and I raced myself, and I worked on Indy 500 pit crews, and I always, if he had a big blow-up or something, I wouldn't go running up to him like most of these guys. But I'd wait a couple hours till he cooled off, and then I'd go talk to him. And, you know, like I said, we always got along really well, and we still do, and I'll always admire that guy. I mean, what a fabulous race driver and a engine man and a mechanic. I mean, you know, he was one of the guys that got me hooked. And Jim Hall and I had a falling out in 1980 when the Chaparral won the Indy 500 with Johnny Rutherford. And I pointed out that the car had been built in England by BS Fabrications and had been designed by John Bernard, which were both true. And Jim Hall came out of his gasoline alley the day after the race and had this Indianapolis Star, and he kind of shoved it in my face, and he said, "Where do you get your information?" I said, "I beg your pardon?" He goes, "Who's BS Fabrication? Who's John Bernard?" I said, "Come on, Jim. What are you talking about? They built and designed and built your car." He goes, "No, Chaparral Racing designed and built that car. You need to get your facts straight." Well, so we didn't speak for 3 or 4 years, and then he retired, and we kind of mended the fence. But I just always felt, I was told, Al Unser told me a couple weeks after the Indy 500 in 1980, we were at Milwaukee, and Al Unser grabbed me when I was walking by, and he said, "Now you know why I quit." Because everybody, remember when Al Unser had the Chaparral in 79 and then quit the ride?
Mm-hmm.
And everybody said, "Why would Al Unser have quit?" Well, he was embarrassed because he was the one that had recruited John Bernard and put that whole deal together, and then Jim Hall wouldn't give John Bernard any credit, wouldn't even mention his name, so Al was mortified. So, you know,
yeah,
I guess.
Let me ask you about one more mystery of IndyCar, Champ Car days. At one time when Alfa Romeo came here with Pat Patrick, is it true that Pat Patrick shipped a Chevy engine to Alfa Romeo in Milan?
That's the story that we always heard, and I think it's probably true.
Wow.
But the problem was Alfa didn't do a very good job of copying him because those things blew up every 10 seconds.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay, now going back to Tom Sneema, this is my favorite story I've heard from you. He used to drive a school bus in his home state, Washington, and stole one in Mexico City. You were there. What happened there?
When he stole the school bus in Mexico City?
Uh-huh.
Well, we were at the racetrack, and everybody stayed downtown, and we took buses to the racetrack every day. And we just kept sitting out there, and the driver wasn't there, and finally, I said to Tom, "Jesus, you know how to drive a school bus. Let's get out of here." So he hopped in the driver's seat, and I was the navigator, and we basically commandeered the bus, and everybody was cheering and laughing, and we parked it on the side street and took off, and they had the police looking for him for about 2 days.
Yeah,
but Tom, he escaped.
Yeah, Tom is a great guy. Okay,
one of the best.
Yeah, you mentioned Al Unser. You know, his son, Junior, was such a nice guy when he was racing, and it is very sad what is happening in his personal life. Any news on what he's doing? Is he still hanging out at the Speedway facilities?
No, he lost his job, and I understand he's been in rehab, and that's good, because the sad thing was he was doing so good. He went two and a half years, and no alcohol, and I did a speaking deal with him one night, and he was so good. Very sharp, very clear-minded, really, really did a good job. And I think we were just all really depressed that it happened, because he'd kind of been, you know, it was kind of a rebirth. He got to do that, I just think that it's a shame that I think if he almost would have stayed around here and he had something to do year-round, it could have worked, you know. It just, I don't know what happened, but it's just, like I said, it's too bad.
It is, yeah. Okay, Rubens Barrichello, are you excited to see an F1 racer in IndyCar racing again?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he used to come to kart races all the time, and you talk about a nice guy. And he's world famous. Everybody knows him, and he's started more Grand Prix than anybody in the history of Formula One, so I think he'll be good for the series, and he's only 40 years old, and, I mean, is it as big as when Nigel Mansell came here? Probably not, because Mansell was the reigning Formula One champ, but it's pretty damn big. I mean, he's got 1.5 million people that follow him on Twitter, just as a matter of fact. Jeff Gordon's got 250,000 or something like that. Barrichello's got 1.5 million.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's, you know, and I think it'll be you know, he's testing this weekend up in your neck of the woods, I think.
Yeah, I'm going there.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't think he'd be going through having another test and going to have a press conference. He wasn't going to drive. I don't think there's any doubt that he's going to drive. And I think he'll run the Indy 500 and probably most of the season. And that'll be good for IndyCar racing, because he's somebody that can sell some tickets.
Oh, no question about it. Okay. The Chinese Formula One Grand Prix is a disaster as far as local attendance is concerned. Do you think IndyCar should be going there?
No, not until they see what... I mean, I just can't imagine... I can't imagine Austin, Texas supporting any kind of race, to be honest. Really can't.
Yeah.
Now, maybe it will do okay the first year. Like, you know, we did okay the first couple years here. But then... you know, and then it just didn't resonate. I mean, nobody, the people kept going because the track was terrible for Formula One. It was a boring race. And then, of course, the Michelin debacle pretty much soured everybody in Formula One. But, you know, I want to see IndyCar go back to Elkhart Lake and, you know, maybe go to Portland or somewhere out in the Pacific Northwest. I'd much rather see us go to places where they used to be a following.
Yeah.
Maybe they could kind of rekindle that interest.
Okay. Robin, the Dan Weldon tragedy was very sad and felt even in Formula One circles. More cars on Vegas track than the field at Indy. Before the race, was there any concern shown by the drivers or any of the officials?
Oh, I mean, you know... The drivers just all said, my God, it's so easy to run wide open. We're running three abreast through turn one. That's insane. I mean, everybody talked about how crazy it was. But, you know, was it any crazier than some of the races have been at Texas? I don't really think so, you know. And I don't think – I mean, there wasn't an outcry where the drivers had a meeting and said, hey, this is insane. You know, we shouldn't be doing – I mean, that didn't happen. It's just, you know, there are ways to survive – you know, when the race started, Dario and Scott Dixon and Danica all dropped back because they saw everybody banging wheels and driving like maniacs five laps into a race. And, you know, they just said, you know, this is, these people, you know, some people are driving crazy. We're backing off and we're going to live for another day. And that's, you know, you got to be smart about it. A lot of these drivers today have never been hurt. And I don't think they understand what the repercussions are running over a wheel in an open-wheel race car. Maybe they do now, but I think if you grew up racing midgets and sprint cars, you know early on that, you know, you don't want to make contact with an open wheel or somebody's going to go for a ride. And I just think the cars have become very safe, and it's real easy to drive them wide open with low horsepower like they have at Texas and Vegas and places like that. And all that does, it's just a... you know, it's just a formula for a disaster. I mean, I've wrote about it for 10 years. It's amazing they haven't killed 10 or 11 drivers on those mile-and-a-half racetracks. They dodged a lot of bullets. And, you know, I think if a couple of people would have been paying attention, I don't think Dan Weldon would have died. And I think if you watch that crash, you know, there were a couple people that went piling into that thing after it started running wide open. And, you know, I just think that probably contributed as much as anything to it. But I don't know. I mean, it's like Tony Stewart said after the race, people watch this sport because it's dangerous. It doesn't have to be foolhardy, but there's an element of danger that makes people want to watch driving, you know, watching races, because that's kind of one of the hooks. And it's not being mean or caustic or anything. That's just, it's a fact.
Yeah. Now, sadly, Greg Moore, another great racing talent, was lost also in a final race of the season. What was the reason for his crash? I never heard about that.
Well, he was driving like a madman at the start of the race. And there's a picture, in Auto Week or Auto Sport. You know, he made it four wide going into turn one. I think he was passing Robbie Gordon on the high side and just, you know, the car was a little bit loose, and he had started last because he'd broken his finger the day before in the paddock when some woman slammed into him.
Right.
So he had to start last, and he told all the guys, I'll see you guys up front in about 10 laps. I mean, he was on a mission to get to the front, and, you know, he lost control. And I think they teach a lot of these guys nowadays, when you spin, stay in the throttle and, you know, don't lock up the brakes, stay in the throttle. And, you know, he got onto the grass and the infield, and then he went flying into the, he hit the little, there was a little road, a little access road, and that flipped his car side, you know, tipped it sideways, and he went into the wall cockpit first. I mean, he didn't have a chance. And, you know, you just think about, he just signed with Roger Penske. How many how many Indy 500s might that guy have won? You might not have ever heard of Castro Neves, because that was Elio took Greg's ride. So
yeah.
All right, brother. Well, I gotta get out of here.
Okay, great. I thank you so much, and hopefully I'll see you at one of the races.
All right, keep those calendars coming.
It's coming. Thank you, sir.
See you later.
Bye bye.
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 Robin, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com.
Hi, I'm Giancarlo Fisichella, and you are listening F1 Weekly.
Okay, Nas, we've got a great interview. Olivier Panis, obviously a lot of history, famous Grand Prix win. Nas introduced this fantastic race driver.
Yeah, well, first of all, I ran into him in the security line of Lyon Airport. I was very, very surprised. And, you know, we had interviewed him last year at Le Mans also. And, of course, his day of days came in Monaco, where a lot of French drivers have scored their first Grand Prix win. Patrick Depailler, Jean-Pierre Bertoil, who was the other one? Who am I missing? There was somebody else who won there. Jean-Pierre Bertoil, Patrick Depailler.
I can't remember. He's the old guy.
And, of course, Maurice Trintignant.
Thank you. That was the
one. There you go.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, anyway, so he was flying out to England to take care of some business, and he has gone from driving a Formula One car to Diesel Jeep, which is an interesting story. I would like to thank him. He was at Le Mans this year and will be doing more races, and is now Bambino is also starting in motorsports and karting right now. So my thanks to Monsieur Olivier Panis, and hope our listeners enjoy this conversation conducted at the Lyon Airport. Okay, folks, I'm here at Lyon Airport with fellow passenger named Olivier Panis. Olivier, welcome back to F1 Weekly. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
I was expecting that you would be driving to the place you won some years ago, Monaco, but you're headed to London. What's happening?
Yeah, well, I have some date in London. I need to see some people, like motor racing people anyway, for the future. And I'm going there 2 days, and I'm looking the Grand Prix for sure. I follow the Grand Prix very, very deep and at home.
Okay, let me ask you a question. Michael Schumacher came back. Everybody thought that he's going to beat the hell out of Rosberg right away. Hamilton has Button as a teammate. Everybody thinks Button is going to get squashed by Hamilton, but it has not turned out that way. How do you look at these situations, starting with Michael first?
Well, with Michael, I think what he did in the moment is pretty good. I mean, after three years off, I think what he's doing is fantastic, really. The teammate of Michael is Nico Rosberg, but he proved last year was pretty quick. This year, in the beginning of the season, he lead the team. Well, I just said Nico is fantastic driver. Michael come back after 3 years, and what he's doing in this moment is pretty good. We need to wait and see what's going on in Monaco and the Grand Prix afterward. But this, I'm quite positive about the return of Michael.
Do you think he will win a race this year?
Well, I think first of all, I think the Mercedes is a good car, but I don't think so is the best. We have 2 Red Bull, we have 2 McLaren, 2 Ferrari, 2 Mercedes. I think it's maybe difficult, but I'm sure he gets some podium.
Okay. Now, what about Jenson Button? He has won 2 races. Hamilton is still looking for one. Are you surprised that Button is doing better than Hamilton, at least in terms of points?
Well, I mean, you never be world champion by hazard. I think Button is a very good driver. He managed very well the race he won. It was complicated race. The weather was pretty bad. In this situation, Button is really strong, and what he proved. But for me, Hamilton is pretty quick. He's like a showman. Sometimes it's a bit too much, but we'll see in the end of this year. But I think for McLaren, it's very good to have 2 drivers like this.
Okay, the first ever Grand Prix took place in Viva la France in 1906. Now we don't have a French Grand Prix. When do you think it will come back, and where will it come back?
I hope so it come back. I mean, we need a French Grand Prix anyway. We love motor racing in France. I know the government work very hard in the moment to find a solution, maybe to still stay in Monaco or maybe somewhere else. We have some very nice circuits like Paul Ricard in France. wait and see. I mean, the best people manage this situation, try to work very hard to find a solution for maybe next year.
Okay, is Paul Ricard up to standards, FIA standards, to hold a race now?
I think so, yeah, because we have a big airport in Paul Ricard. I mean, the facility is not better to Monaco, to be honest, but the circuit is fantastic. It's brand new. It's easy to put some. It's a lot of job to do for a spectator, but I think it's not difficult things.
I have an idea. Tell me what you think about my idea. I think they should do two races in Monaco: Monaco Grand Prix and Viva la France Grand Prix in Monte Carlo. What do you think?
For me, it's a good idea. I love this track. I love this place. I don't think so. Bernie accept that, but I don't think so. It's a stupid idea, really.
Okay. To tell our listeners what you're up to these days in motor racing.
Sorry?
What are you up to in motor racing these days?
These days, I mean, I'm doing. I'm still working with Orica. I'm drive. Luckily, I drive Peugeot 908 for Le Mans. Diesel car, it's different philosophy of motor racing with diesel engine, but I'm really pleased for that because it's one of the best cars for endurance on this moment. We prepare Le Mans for, I think now we still have 1 month left to doing well, and we hope we fight for podium in Le Mans. I'm still doing GT in France with a Corvette. Using my time to continue motor racing. This is part of my life. I feel physically good to doing it. I try to continue to doing it.
Is it possible for a private Orica team in a Peugeot turbo diesel to beat the team car?
Well, I think so. It's possible. Everything is possible in 24 with Le Mans. In Spa, we are second before somebody crushed me in the back of the car and pushed me off. And we are behind one of Peugeot official, we have front of two Audi, two Peugeot official. I think we have a team to doing well. We have, I have two teammates very fast, Nicolas Lapierre and Loïc Duval. Well, I think we have a right team to doing well in Le Mans.
Okay, nice to know you're going fast in your professional life, but in your personal life you have slowed down. Will you please tell our listeners what you're driving now and why?
Well, now
I'm sorry to rub it in again.
Nah, it's not a problem. Now I drove a Jeep, diesel, to be sure it's
diesel.
Not diesel. It's to be sure I'm not go over 150 km on the motorway because I take a big speed limit last year and I have 4 points left. It means I need to be very calm for one more year to have the opportunity to get some point more. Come back, sorry.
Okay, your country has produced two other drivers, both very good, and I want to know from you, since you know both of them, who is more crazy, Jean Alesi or René Arnoux?
Oh, I think both is very close, to be honest. Well, René, I like him because he's the generation before me, but he was funny guy, very quick. I mean, he don't care about a lot of things, just motor racing is part of his life, and the race he's doing in Dijon with Villeneuve for me was one of the best race I never seen F1, and for this I have a big respect of him. Jean is a crazy also, but he's a very nice guy. I mean, out of the car he's one of the best person I never met. When he going to the car, when he put the helmet on, he's also a bit crazy, but in different way. But I like him a lot.
Okay, please tell our listeners about your son. How old is he, and what is he doing in sport motorsports right now?
Well, unluckily, he likes motor racing. he's 15 years old, and the name is Aurélien, and he started the go-kart last year. Now he's in an official team in France doing go-kart. I hope so when he was young. I believe he liked football, tennis, or something else, not motor racing, because I love it, motor racing, but I know how much it's difficult to making a good career. But anyway, he liked it. I help him now.
Is mom behind supporting him?
My wife, when I told her Aurélien was doing a go-kart during 2 weeks, she don't speak to me because she was really upset about me, about the kids. But after that, she's also, I mean, he like it. Now we need to follow him.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for your time.
Olivier Panis, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com.
Here's this week's F1Weekly.com trivia answer. Canadian driver Al Piess was black flagged during the 1969 Canadian Grand Prix for what reason? That was for driving too slowly. He's the only driver in Formula One history ever to have suffered that penalty. Harrison Ford. Talk to you again next week. Bye now.